America, when the sun goes down, and I sit on the old broken down river pier watching the long, long skies over New Jersey, and sense all that raw land that rolls in one unbelievable huge bulge over to the West Coast, and all that road going.
Watching me, you know, he's a fountain. You know, and my brother Ray, he grabs the microphone, right? Because the only mic they had back in those days was just for the singer. They didn't mic the amps or anything. So he just took the mic, stick it down here like this, right? So I just took my amplifier, turned it on.
Just before the coming of complete night that blesses the earth, darkens all the rivers, cups the peaks, holds the final shore in. Nobody, nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody besides the forlorn rags of growing old.
No,
I think of Dean Moriarty, I even think old Dean Moriarty, the father we never met.
There was a bowling alley on Route 66 just outside Oklahoma City that we used to stop in and play at with some regularity. We got to know the people enough. We, you know, it was really comfortable. We'd roll in and go get some free corn dogs, play the video games over in their arcade, and we were invited to bowl if we wanted. I don't think we ever did. But on one memorable occasion, we had an opening act that was a magician. I believe his name was Donnie Vomit. And he, at one point, broke a light bulb in a paper bag and then ate the pieces in parts. And then a few moments later, he took a very long needle and stuck it through both cheeks. He was pretty good, but it was unusual as an opening act for a rock and roll band, although this was a bowling alley. So anyway, I became friends with the sound man a little bit, you know, a little chummy. And one time I walked in and I just said to him, as he was getting ready, I said, "Hey, what's up, man? It's good to see you. How's it going?" And he got really irritated and he just was flustered and he said, "Man, this is Oklahoma City. Nothing ever happens." So I went, "Whoa, all right." And went back to getting my gear together and doing whatever I was doing and didn't bring it up again. And anyway, we play our show and we go on tour, and then a few months later we're coming through again and we're stopping at the bowling alley again, more corn dogs, you know. And so I see him, the sound man, and I just reflexively say, "Hey man, what's up? How's it going?" And he goes, "I told you, nothing ever happens in Oklahoma City." And I was like, "Whoa. All right, man. Rock and roll, I suppose." I think that was the night someone kicked all the urinals off the men's room walls. Woo! We were in Las Vegas. And the next day was going to be in Denver. And we had a daytime show and a nighttime show. And so we wanted to leave right after the gig in Vegas and get through the Rockies and just wake up in Denver. And I volunteered to drive all night. I was so good at that usually. But on this particular occasion, I managed to get us up into Utah and up into those Rockies and up in those high mountains where it's super dark and really dangerous. And I started getting sleepy. Everyone else was asleep. No one was awake speaking with me. I wasn't playing music because they needed the quiet to sleep. And I had promised I would do this. And So I was going to keep my word, but my eyes were drooping and the heat was on. It was really cold up there. And anytime I turned off the heat because it was drying out my eyeballs and making things so much more worse, one of the band members would wake up and complain. So I'd put the heat back on and then crack the window. And then another band person would wake up and complain about that. And so I stopped at a gas station. I got a tall coffee and a Red Bull. And I drank those things and they didn't help. My head started nodding and I'd never had these problems before, but there was no getting around it. I was in bad shape and this was really dangerous. So at one point, after a few hours and it was getting really scary, I pulled over on the side of the road and I started doing jumping jacks. I'm in the headlights of the van, it's pitch black out there except for those headlights and the stars, and I'm out there doing jumping jacks, and every once in a while I slap myself across the face. And then I'm thinking, man, this is crazy, and I'm laughing because it's so goddamn stupid. And stupid and unnecessary, but here I am. I said I'd do it, and this is part of the deal. And I'm up there doing jumping jacks. And then after a while, I'm like, well, I may as well stand out here for a while and let the cold really get in me. And then that'll maybe help. And so as I'm standing there, I notice that gently rolling off to the right of the shoulder was a very slow, curving cliffside. And it was so dark down there that I couldn't really see where it ended, but I could see that if I rolled a rock from where we were parked, it would just go off into the dark and fall into a very high up gorge where, when I crept kind of close to the edge, I could hear a very distant river below. And just that sound indicated just how far down that drop was. It was far. And that kind of woke me up. I was like, oh boy, there it is. That could be a problem. There's no guardrails or anything because this basically runs a very long distance. And so it's up to you to stay on the road and not drive off the gently sloping cliff. And as I'm standing there considering this, very dangerous thing, I notice that the headlights are picking up an object about 60-70 feet in front of the van, and I go, well, I've got time. I'm gonna wake myself up. I'm gonna take a little stroll. So I walk down to the white glowing object that is like a beacon out there. And when I get there, I see it's a little white cross with flowers on it and some names of people who were killed in that location, presumably driving off that very cliff. Well, that was sobering.
Good night, superstitious. A black cat just crossed my trail.
So I got in the car with a renewed sense of purpose, and I drove another hour, and then it started coming back, the tired. My head was drooping, everything was happening, but by then the sun was almost coming up, and I surrendered. I surrendered. I woke up the guys, and I said, I'm sorry, I'm dead. I am dead tired. And so all the guys woke up and they lit cigarettes and they turned down the heat because it was hot in there. And they cranked up the music and they did all the things that helps keep you awake. And they were wondering, why were you so sleepy? And I didn't even answer. I just got my big coat and I wrapped it around my head and I went to the far back of the van and I went out cold and slept. And when I woke up, we were in Denver. But more importantly, we were alive.
A big train coming out the tunnel down the track. On the transportation, there's nothing that it lacks. I don't know if I'm coming, no, I ain't going back. Come along and ride the big train. Big train, big train. Come along and ride the big train. Big train,
big train. A contributing factor to our juvenile delinquency of today. I 100% believe. Why I believe that is because I know how it feels when you sing. I know what it does to you. And I know the evil feeling that you feel when you sing. I know the
the lost position that you get into in the beat. Well, if you talk to the average teenager of today and you ask them what it is about rock and roll music that they like, and the first thing they'll say is the beat.
We always made a point of playing the 15th Street Tavern in Denver, Colorado. We'd gotten to know people who worked there and considered the whole group a bunch of friends, and it felt like being at home, which makes a big difference when you're out on the road for 8 weeks or something, and then you finally come across some people you just know, you have a beer, you relax, you chat, you catch up, all the good stuff. And then this particular occasion, it wasn't just the friends and family routine, it was Halloween, so everyone was really dressed up. All the people I knew were there and they had really gone for it. So much so that when two police officers walked by me inside the club, I thought they were faking it. I thought they were in costumes. And for a mad second, I almost grabbed the gun of one of them. I thought it would be funny, but it turns out they were there to provide security for us. So I'm really glad I did not act on that impulse. Later in the night when the show started, it was so full and crazy and loud and flashing lights and everything was happening. And I just wanted to talk about this one young guy who'd shown up dressed as Angus Young from AC/DC. He was in a little schoolboy uniform and he had a fake cardboard Gibson SG he'd cut and painted, and he had a guitar strap on it, and he was dancing, stomping his foot just like Angus Young as he plays guitar. And the whole time we're playing, he's getting more and more out of control, getting closer and closer to getting on stage himself, and he's so enthusiastic and he's so caught up in the moment of the loud aggressive rock and roll that he's just really going for it, as is a lot of people in the crowd. A lot of people are jumping towards us and a lot of people are all around, and I'm stepping into the crowd and they're all pushing me around in a friendly way, and the singer's getting attacked by a young woman who keeps screaming her name, Lisa! And so it's getting really pretty crazy. We're surrounded, but it feels warm and comfortable, and we couldn't be happier, really. This is what you want. This is what you're looking for. It doesn't have to be a huge crowd, but 100 people who are just really going for it in a small, dingy little dive joint can be the best experience. There's not even a stage, it's about an 8-foot riser, just enough to make you feel like something's happening. You're the center of focus. And so you're really going for it, playing so hard, and I keep looking out and seeing this young Angus, and this Angus Young guy, and he's jumping up and down and swinging his little cardboard cutout guitar every which way. And then he must have done something wrong because he ran afoul of the police who were there protecting us. Thank you very much, officers, I guess. But suddenly Angus lifted off of the ground and started floating upwards and above the crowd backwards, and his guitar was ripped out of his hand and he drifted as though crowd surfing, but he was being lifted by the police who carried him out. I could see him go all the way to the exit and then just disappear from my life forever. And I felt bad for Angus Young. After the show was over, we hung out for a little while, talking to friends, and just feeling good about things, you know? Just being part of the community for a minute, having maybe a final drink. And then we started cleaning up our stuff, wiping down guitars, packing them up, getting them out to the car, because we probably had a long drive in the morning. And it was better to go get some rest. So as we loaded out, I was walking to the exit carrying gear. And I looked down and there was Angus's sad little guitar left there on the ground, doomed to be thrown away. And so I said a silent thank you to Angus as I put my foot in the middle of the guitar, ripped the strap right off and shoved it in my gig bag in one motion and just kept going to the van. I can always use a spare strap. Thank you, Angus. The only time I ever played in Orlando, Florida was at some club with an opening group who had a great name. They were called the Joint Chiefs. Now, this was a very grooving band that had a lot of people and a lot of percussion, and it was so much fun. They were so upbeat, and we really enjoyed the whole night. We had a good crowd, and everything was very positive. And we parked outside in the loading zone right in front of the club on the major street. And after the show and all the chatting and the whatnot that goes on after, we started carrying our gear out, loading it into the van. And while still talking to the Joint Chiefs and the people who wanted to stick around and chat after, it was a good environment. And so I'm standing at the back of the van with the two doors open up. And I'm placing a couple soft pack gig bag guitars on top of everything when the door and bumper to my left, which was facing traffic, exploded and the whole van rocked. And everything that we had just put in the van, or a large portion of it, hurtles out and hits me. Guitars, CDs, t-shirts that we're trying to sell, pieces and parts of drums and whatnot, they all come and spill in the street. And the whole thing is so loud and so violent that I'm in shock. And I back up and I look, and the front, the door that was next to me had been bent all the way around and now was pointing towards the front of the van, and the bumper's half ripped off. And a car had just struck us. It didn't even make sense. It was so quick and violent. And when I looked around the side of the van, I could see it. It was a really large pickup. And it was going away really slow from us, slow and steady, like 20, 25 miles an hour. And as I'm sitting there just staring at it make this very slow getaway down a very long road, these people come rushing over, the fans, the friends, whatever, and they're asking me if I'm okay. And a guy amongst them had a bicycle, and he took off and he chased down the truck and tried to flag it to stop, and it wouldn't stop. But he came back and he had the license plate number of the truck. And he had the make and model and a description of the driver. Now, this guy was great. And I thanked him, and I stood there waiting for the police to show up as the rest of the band took in the scene. And we'd had so much trouble on this tour, it was just one more issue that was really devastating. Now, as I stood there, I was thinking about how this truck had almost hit me from behind, which would have pinned me against the van, and it could only have been really bad. I thought about the implications of what would have occurred to my body, and I was feeling not so good. But I was keeping it together, because just around that time, two bicycle police officers rolled up. And now, this happened very quickly. We could still see the pickup truck just slowly moving away from us. And so I said to the police officer, we were just struck by what I would assume is a drunk driver. And there he is. We were parked here, and he's still there. You can catch him on your bike. And the police officer said, we're not going to do that. And I said, okay, well, we've got this information on his truck, and maybe you could trace it to his address and then wait for him to arrive at home and get him then. And the police officer said, we're not going to do that either. And then he pulled out his citation book and wrote us a ticket for a parking violation. He said we were illegally in a loading zone. And I tried to argue that that's where the club told us to park, because we were literally loading in and out, and he wasn't having any of it. And then I bit my tongue and just stayed that way. And I tried to get the singer away, because she's got some strong opinions, and the fact was, we didn't have insurance on this particular journey, and so we didn't want to get into it with the police. So afterwards, the other band, the Joint Chiefs, stepped up and said, hey, why don't you come and stay with us? And so they helped us bend our door around so that we could tie it to the other door that's still shut right. And then we had already, of course, cleaned up everything, and then we drove over to their place. And while we're sitting there, I'm starting to like feel the shock wear off, and I'm starting to feel everything. Just everything. I could feel the blood drain from my face, and I felt like I might just fall over. So I sat on the floor and leaned against the couch, and the singer, Lisa, looks over at me. She goes, "Oh, you're starting to feel it now, aren't you?" And I said, "I am. I almost died." And just then, one of the band guys, one of the joint chiefs, handed me this big rolled cigarette. And he goes, "This is just what you need." And yet it wasn't a cigarette at all. And I agreed, that might be what I need. And so I took some of that. And then he put on a documentary about Fela Kuti, a saxophone player who led a band and a whole political movement in Africa. And it was so invigorating and so powerful that by the end, it was about 5 a.m. and I was still sitting there, but I was so tuned into the sound and the music and the electrifying performances by Fela and his band that the sound of the crashing truck into our van, which had haunted me the whole night, started to fade and just turn into a saxophone that was very invigorating and healthy. And it felt so good to finally let go of the violence of that crash and just drift off once the documentary ended. Special thanks to the Joint Chiefs. Thanks for your brotherhood. And more special thanks to the two mechanics in Atlanta, Georgia, who spent their entire Sunday locating a new van door for us and attached it for free. They wouldn't accept any payment. I don't know your names, but you're amazing, and thank you.
Make you not go anywhere. Just wait till they make I tell you something.
Fella, you don't come again.
I never come again. I still live far away. Make you wait till I reach where they go. Don't ask me. Wait and see. Make a hurry. Don't ask me. Wait and see. I say.
I was playing bass guitar on most of these tours, and so one time we're staying at this house that's on a hillside, and it's got a lot of hedges and bushes out front, and to get up to the front or in the house, you had to walk up this stone zigzagging stairway that was very uneven and illogical. And I had this touring bass amplifier that was an SVT that's made by Ampeg, and it's an amazing amplifier, but the two elements both weigh a great amount. So I had to take off the top and carry it up by itself. And then I went down, I got my guitars, and I went up those stone steps. And then I went down lastly for the speaker cabinet, which had 8 10-inch speakers, each one with very heavy magnets. And the thing is, around almost 5 feet tall, and they must be 2 feet wide, if not more, and a foot and a half deep, and it's so heavy. It had a set of built-in wheels so you could lean it back and pull it by the built-in handle. Like they said, the makers said, this thing's heavy. We better build in some stuff to help these poor scrawny musicians get this thing around. And it does help usually, but on these stairs, it wasn't helping much. So now it's about 4 in the morning. I've had some drinks and I'm weary, very weary. And I'm trying to pull this heavy thing. It weighs more than me, and I'm trying to pull it up these stone steps, and I'm bumping along, and I'm getting almost up there, when all of a sudden it starts tilting the wrong way, and I'm pulling on the handle, but it's pulling me. The cabinet is pulling me, and now it's fallen on its face, and it's brought me with it. And so now we are going down these stairs like the cabinet is a toboggan, and I'm riding it. I'm holding the handle, and all I can do is hold on and wait and see what happens. And what happens is the stairs take an abrupt left turn going down the hill, and I was unable to make that turn because I'm not really steering. And so the cabinet rams a massive hedge and flips me over the hedge, and I land further down the slope on my back amidst a bunch of ivy. And I'm just laying there, and I'm looking up at the sky, the stars, the moon, and I don't immediately get up. I lay there a little while. And I just think about all the bad decisions I'd ever made that had led me to this moment of contemplation amidst the plants. Rock and roll, it ain't always pretty, but it's worth it. What you're hearing is the board mix from a gig we did in about 2000 at Club Congress in Tucson, Arizona. A club that knows how to treat its musicians well.